You're listening to Earful of Queer on CFRU 93.3. This is the first half of a panel recorded last June at Queer Riot here in Guelph. This panel features Lime Jello from Hamilton. In the first portion of this panel, they discuss the ins and outs of different types of sex work. They also provide some analysis of why different folks are doing sex work and the kinds of work that they do, with particular attention to influences of colonialism, patriarchy, and racism. The latter part of this portion answers some questions that folks have about sex work. They also discuss the current legal situation in Ontario and talk about ways that sex workers are working around these laws, as well as providing an analysis of gentrification and how this affects where sex workers can work and the types of work that they do.
Okay, so there's a lot of different kinds of sex work. I have a list here. It's hardly exhaustive, but it's a place to start. There's indoor and outdoor prostitutes, hustlers, hookers, escorts, service providers, which is what our clients call us when they talk about us on the internet, sugar babies who have sugar daddies, porn actors and porn workers, the camera operators, the writers, that sort of stuff, strippers, exotic dancers, burlesque and drag performers, pro doms, pro subs, phone sex operators, cam sex operators, anyone else whose business is sex. I like to add wives to that, but they don't get any advocacy from us. We did the boundaries of the discussion. I know human trafficking, it makes me rant. We need to give you a definition of decriminalization versus legalization. Sometimes people will say, oh, sex work needs to be legalized so that everybody's protected, and they don't quite get the difference between the two ideas. So legalization is a system where, yes, they stop making it illegal to do things associated with sex work, and that's awesome, but then they start making new laws, like that you have to work in this particular area, and we're not going to enforce anti-violence laws there because we don't care if you get hurt. Or you have to have a weekly STD check. This is really common in legalized systems. What sex workers have said, the problem with this is when you put that certificate up on your wall saying, I've had my weekly STD check, I don't have any AIDS or hepatitis or herpes or whatever, then your client says, awesome, I'm not wearing a condom. And that takes away your bargaining chip that you can affect into something. And also, just like if the government wants to look at my pussy, they gotta pay me. So legalized systems generally don't work in favor of sex workers. They work in favor of people who think it's okay and get squeamish and want it somewhere else and somewhere controlled. Decriminalization is removing all laws that limit our activities as workers from the criminal code. So the communication law that says you can't communicate in public for the purpose of prostitution, which includes how much you're going to get paid, what exactly are you going to do for that amount of money, are you a serial killer before I get in your car, that's all against the law. Keeping common body house, which is the regular maintenance of a building for the purpose of obscene acts. And that applies to any kind of indoor sex work. And various pimping and procuring laws that sound good on the surface. Pimping is an equal thing, I guess. But they're really vague, so anyone over the age of 14 who lives with you or takes money from you or is regularly in your company, if they can't prove they're not living off your income, they're your pimp. And that means your kids, your partner, your friends, vice versa. It's bad news. So that would be the removal of all those laws, and then we just run like any other business runs and subject to the same business codes and labor legislation.
And I think an important point is that, so like as an anarchist, I would be against decriminalization because I don't believe in the legislative system and that sort of thing. But I think it's important to know that it goes beyond that with sex workers, because what it actually does is the immediate here and now, if you have a system of legalization, creates a really precarious situation for them and everybody else around them, right? So, I mean, ideologically I'm against the system, but it's also a sense of, like, making sure that they are as safe as they possibly can be, right? Because the idea is that CAS can come in, they can take away any of your assets. It just makes those workers much more precarious. It means that they then end up as outdoor workers who end up as extremely precarious, right? And those outdoor workers will then be shifted and moved off by the neighborhood associations, by the police, by whoever it is, the city council who doesn't like them. So what you're doing is you're just moving people farther and farther into a much more precarious situation.
Yeah, and I'll reiterate Megan's thing. It's really important when we're talking about sex workers and being their allies, we need to work in the framework that exists. After the revolution, does not cut it. But after the revolution, totally, I'm with you. But for the moment, like, I'd like to not go to jail. And now I need to tell you who does sex work and more. Okay. So most sex workers are women. About 80% of sex workers are women. And when I say women, I know people need to define their own genders. But most sex workers would define their gender as a woman, whether they're a trans woman or a cis woman. So that's what I go with. You're welcome to challenge me on that. And the 20% who are men, something that people tend not to know about them is most of them identify as straight men. So there's, it's really hard for male sex workers to come out and say, I'm doing sex work, I'm sucking cock, or guys are sucking my cock for money, because people automatically assume they're gay. And for a straight man, that's a hard thing. Oh, poor help, straight men. Yeah. Yeah. But as workers, that homophobia makes it really hard for them to access basic human civil and labor rights. So it looks like something where queers and sex workers need to be allies.
Yeah. I think another sort of important point that when you look at the framing in sort of mainstream media and representation and discussion of sex workers, they get framed as the helpless women. So there's sort of two main ways, right? They either get framed as the really helpless woman who is, like, drug addicted, has mental health issues, and just needs, like, a good Christian helping, right? Or they get framed as the social problem who, for some, like, some reason, is the sole person and reason why there is addictions, there is poverty, there is violence, all these sorts of things in your neighborhood, right? That's the sort of two ways they get framed. And, well, I don't have much empathy for the straight men, but it is, that makes it difficult to place themselves within that framework, right? So the mainstream framework tells us that the people who are doing sex work are doing because they've been abused and they've led these really shitty lives, which may be true, it may not be true, but then those straight men don't fit into that framework, so it makes it very difficult to then, they have to assume to be gay in order to receive some sort of services from social service type folks.
This is the newsletter we wrote for that Hostile Neighborhood Association, so I'm trying to translate it into something human.
Because you guys are not hostile, which is lovely.
So, and this is something I hope we can talk about after we get done giving you this basic information, because this is somewhere where I find it really difficult to communicate facts to people while dealing with their various prejudices. Sex workers are not helpless victims, but the reality is definitely that the common experiences that get a person over that stigma to start doing sex work as a way to make ends meet is experiences of poverty and violence, and lots of it. Most sex workers have left home long before the age of 18, and there aren't a whole lot of viable options that aren't sex work. Like, every sex worker I know, more than capable of flipping burgers at McDonald's. That's not a viable option. You can't survive on minimum wage. So it's not that they're so helpless and victimized that they can't protect their own bodies, but it is that they're trapped in an economic system where they have to make money to survive. And there's not always complete choice and consent about labor for any of us. So that's something I hope we can talk about. Because racism and colonialism have made some people even more trapped in that economic system, Aboriginal women are grossly overrepresented in outdoor sex workers. And that's, again, a problem because they're subject to a lot of violence and it's a double stigma. It's okay to hurt sex workers, it's okay to hurt Aboriginal women, the police aren't going to investigate if they go missing. But not because they're helpless, because of the system.
Prostitution. your mother, your neighbor, your baby mama, and all that drama too. If I'm not you, then I definitely am a part of you. Prostitution. No longer will you hold me down, 'cause I am everywhere. You're
It's not an area of behavior that really can be controlled or should be controlled by criminal law. It's consensual conduct between two or more people. It's been going on as long as recorded history. And I think trying to stop it through the use of criminal law has proven to be an enormous failure that has led to corruption. It has led to violence.
I'm coming out, I'm making all my whole revolutionaries come sing and shout. You cannot hold me down, 'cause I am everywhere.
An enormous failure that has led to corruption, it has led to violence, and it certainly has not lessened prostitution.
So here's the tricky thing about our labor rights. Professional training doesn't exist in the sex industry. And while I will definitely tell you how some people do sex work and hypothetically what might be a practical way to do sex work, I'm legally prohibited from telling you to do sex work. It's pimping. Even if it's the best option for you and you're totally consenting, it's against the law. So just try to frame your questions so that we're able to answer them. So there's different ways of doing sex work. I don't want to say the best way to do it. If you're a woman, likeliest the safe way to do sex work is indoors. A lot of men have told me they feel safer working outdoors. And that's just because if your client's gonna pick a fight with you, like a guy who identifies as straight and is married and has kids and has a job as like a school teacher or whatever, does not want to be caught beating up a gay hooker on the street corner. So you're pretty safe outdoors if you're men. It goes the other way with women because nobody notices or cares. There's different ways to work indoors. There's in-call and out-call prostitution. So in-call would be where you maintain the body house, which is against the law, so please don't do that. Outcall is technically legal because there is no law against exchanging sex for cash. So as long as your client doesn't have sex workers over so regularly that he's maintaining a body house, then that would be legal. Go.
I've heard that there's also one of the procurement laws is around transportation. So like even if you like call a cab to get to an outcall, that could potentially like incriminate the cab driver since you paid the cab driver to escort you there.
Yeah, so cab driver's not going to be charged.
Yeah, but like more concerned like if you have a friend who needs to drive you or something.
If you have a friend who works as your employer contractor driving you, that's yeah, that person can be charged as pimping you. And there's also a law about transporting a person to a body house for the purpose of prostitution. It's a different part of the pimping law. And I don't remember if that's for only if you're transporting a prostitute or if you're transporting a prostitute or a client, so that might be something you want. But assuming you drive yourself, or walk, or take a bus, some sex workers like to tack the cab fare onto the client's charge. They are always willing to pay the extra 50 or 60 or 100 bucks, however much it costs to get you there. I suggest doubling what the cab fare actually costs. They don't know. They don't take cabs. So yeah, so you can be an in-call or an out-call sex worker. There's pros and cons to each. A lot of sex workers feel safer doing out-call work because they aren't afraid of getting arrested or aren't as afraid of getting arrested. The cops will still pull you over, drag you to your car, harass you, and treat you like shit. But they can't haul you off to jail for out-call prostitution. They also like not having to clean up before and afterwards. You get to get dressed up kind of nice and go over to somebody's house. They will give you food and booze and pretty much whatever you ask for because they're horny, so that can be fun. The downsides are you're walking into someone else's space. If it comes down to having to terminate a relationship, it's you who has to gather your stuff and go. You can't just talk someone the fuck out. And there's a sense of that lack of control because you don't know what's there. You could be walking into an apartment with 5 men in it when you're expecting 1, or 10 men when you're expecting 5, or 1 man when you're expecting 5, and then you get paid a fifth of what you're expecting to get paid. So sometimes it's better to maintain your own space. And then your own space, really safe. You can definitely get arrested. One of the ways sex workers get around this law is to work in hotel rooms, and I think this is really resourceful. In order to be regularly maintaining this place, I don't know if this is the letter of the law or just how the police go about busting people, again, something you might want to look up, but generally they'll watch you. And if they see you using it for 3 days, they can establish that you would regularly maintain the space. So if you're renting a hotel room and you do it for 2 days and then you switch rooms, that's technically a different private space. But again, I wouldn't take that as the ultimate protection. They're the cops. They're going to say what they want. They're going to do what they want.
And the thing is with that too, that which we were discussing last night, is that you actually have to do the whole like checking out process and then rechecking in again. So like you couldn't do the really fun thing of like, you know, if she's in room 1 and I'm in room 2, then like, oh, we've been in for 2 days, now we're going to swap, right? Because technically room 1 is still under my name, right? So you'd have to do that whole process of checking out in order to make sure that like you were covered by that.
Yeah, that's a lot of work. But as long as most police departments have a policy that they're not actively going after indoor sex workers. So as long as you're not political, you're not advocating for your labor rights, you're not, you know, there's a chance they'll leave you alone. It's never guaranteed. And then the benefits are that it's your space, you can control everything that happens, you have all your supplies with you, and if they fuck with you, you throw them out. And if they don't want to be nice about it, you kind of give them an option. Do you want to leave with your clothes in 2 minutes after I let you get dressed? Or do you want to leave now while I'm hitting you with things naked and stand on my front lawn? So, and that makes them a little more agreeable. I keep talking about them like you're going to have to throw every client out. One sex worker I know has been working for almost 4 years, has tossed people 4 times. So,
I think it would be useful if we talked a bit about how you would advertise and how you would then obtain clients, procure clients.
Okay. So there's different ways of advertising. If you're an outdoor worker, you stand on the street and look available. And there's posture to this. Once you get used to seeing sex workers and talking to them and enjoying their company, you'll start to look at women on the street and you can tell which ones are working. Just sort of by the way they stand. I can't even explain this. It's just, it gets passed down among outdoor sex workers too. This is how to stand in order to look available and attract clients. This is how to stand when you just want to be left alone. So, if you want to work outdoors, I would suggest getting together with some local outdoor sex workers and getting some advice from them. If you want to work indoors, then again, you have options. Some people advertise like on Craigslist. There are websites like theredzone.com where people advertise. There are escort review boards where clients get together and say nice things and not nice things about sex workers they've had sex with. Some people advertise on there. There's a lot of very dedicated clients there who make a point of seeing all the sex workers and comparing them so you can get a lot of money out of them. But there's culture that goes with that. A lot of straight men who get to say nice things and not nice things about women. You can advertise in the back of your weekly newspaper, like in Hamilton you have The View. I don't know if you have like Pulse or something here.
The Echo.
Yeah, the weekly newspapers tend to be really, really expensive, and they charge way more to sex workers than to regular workers. You could advertise at the back of the Mercury, too, like if you were doing massage, you just wouldn't mention, like, sexy massage. And people will figure it out when they get there. I don't know where else you would advertise. Oh, some people use, like, phone dating lines, too. That's a lot of work, because they kick you off, and they call you a whore. It's a lot of work, but you get some really, like, clingy, loving, sugar daddy-type clients that'll give you lots of money. And same with, like, a lot of, like, chat rooms.
Do folks have other questions that, or other information that you'd like some more information about?
Yeah.
Hypothetically, if someone had offered to purchase a sex toy that a woman had used, is that legal?
I can't give you legal advice. I could give you legal information. Offering to buy it definitely isn't illegal. Unless you're doing it like on the street corner in public, but if it's in a private space, there's nothing wrong with that. Actually selling your toys and your panties, as long as it's no contact, I think you should be fine. Like, people sell panties over the internet all the time, and it's a great gig. You can get, like, you go buy 2 pairs of panties from the dollar store for a buck and rub them on your cunt and sell them for 50. And they, like, smell them, jerk off them and stuff. Everybody's happy. But yeah, I think that would be okay.
And you, like, mail stuff.
Yeah. It would get complicated if you're seeing them in person and touching them and then giving them the toys. Or if someone wants, not you.
Someone.
Yeah. Sorry, I saw that there was another hand somewhere over in this area.
I was just wondering about, like, the wording of things on Craigslist. Like, you don't say, like, I will trade sex for money. You say something other than that.
Yeah, Craigslist has all these ridiculous rules. Like, you can't say into my, as in into my house. Like, because you could also say into my pussy. You can't say condom, which is a problem. And they figure it's legal in the States. They're a States-based company, so let's just make it a pain in the ass across the board. On Craigslist, sometimes people use code for things. For some reason, they don't censor the dollar sign. So you can put 100 half hour. What does that mean? You know, it's not outright solicitous, I guess. Usually you would just put up a description of yourself, or someone would put up a description of her or himself. I'm 6'3", 100 pounds. Yeah. And of course you make it, you know, those ridiculous typical standards of beauty. Like, if I were to describe myself, I'd say I'm 5'9", 140 pounds, long curly blonde hair and green eyes and long legs and big tits and a hot ass, and my body loves attention.
That's true.
It is true, but do I really go around introducing myself to people like that? And you make yourself sound, or one makes herself sound, or himself sound sexy. And you put on the high heels, and you put on the fucking dress, and when you greet them at the door, you're all smiles, and you're nice, and you're bubbly, and you're friendly, and yeah, it kind of sucks. But then you take their money. And you use it to fund the shit that you want to do.
So, if one were to, hypothetically, be for a long-term relationship, how would it seem to work?
I only know one person who's doing that, so I only have this one perspective. And I also have my perspective where I would feel, like, beyond uncomfortable in a relationship like that, because sugar daddies can be a bit controlling. You will look like this. You will be here at this time. I'm paying you. There is a website where you can advertise yourself as a sugar baby. And, like, the kind of relationship you're going for is the kind where he's your daddy and you're his baby. So understand that getting into it, that these men will treat you a certain way. There are sugar mamas, there's just not as many of them, which is unfortunate. You negotiate usually gifts and trips and paying your rent. You won't get a whole lot of cash in hand. And it depends on the ability to be sweet. Hey, could you help me out? Could you do me a favor? Oh, I messed up and I maxed out all my credit cards. What am I going to do? rather than just saying, look, it's $200 or you got to go home. Like, it's a different way. Yes. See, I would buy you those shoes, and then I would feel like a hero, and you would suck my dick. Yes.
Exactly.
So I know there's a bit of learning how to work that personality.
I think like it's also so important to mention that in any of the relationships that you would engage in, that or any of the types of work you engage in, I should say, that there are workers who've done this for years and years, and that you can form sort of impromptu apprenticeships with folks, right? Like, if you can make a connection in a relationship with someone who is doing that already, who is a sugar baby, and you can say, like, look, I'd like some information and some guidance around that. Like, how would I negotiate that? How would I advertise that? All those sorts of things. Like, workers are quite willing to do that and to offer that training. Because, like we said before, it's not something you could be like, Mohawk College, sex working, sign me up, you know? It's not something you can do, right? So, like any trade, like any skilled work, there's always that apprenticeship program that falls into it, right? So,
yeah. And those can be shop around when you're doing this. Some agencies are run by people who have never done sex work but who really like to take your money. And other times you'll have a more, like it says it's an agency, but it's just one other worker and you work together. And that can be a slightly better relationship, so you have to protect yourself. It's also a really competitive and cutthroat industry. So, yeah, you want that training, but you don't want this person to, like, say, oh, of course I'll help you out, come talk to me, and then go on the review board and say, oh my god, she has the herpes! And screw over all your business. So, like, be careful. Don't just assume somebody's going to help you because she's not there to help you, she's there to make money. On Annie Sprinkle's website, there's some really great resources for sex workers. One of them is how to counter or fight against sex worker burnout. It's a little poster. I like that.
Step into my life.
Of prostitution because of its oppressive application.
Decriminalize me.